Well, welcome along to church this morning. It's great that you can be with us. We are in our Wisdom Literature series where we've been looking previously at the books of Proverbs, and now we are looking at the book of Ecclesiastes. And last week we sort of saw that there was a bit of a difference between Ecclesiastes and the Proverbs. The Proverbs seem to be quite bright and optimistic and idealistic. If you do this, good thing. If you follow the voice of wisdom, good stuff will happen in your life. If you follow the voice of folly or wickedness, bad stuff's going to happen in your life. Well, when we come to the book of Ecclesiastes, we've seen that not everything is as straightforward as we would like it to be, or that perhaps as Proverbs presents it. Sometimes we follow the voice of wisdom and tragedy ensues. Sometimes people follow the voice of wickedness and it seems like their lives are comfortable and luxurious. Not everything is as it seems, and this is where the book of Ecclesiastes really helps us. The passage we looked at today, I think possibly the first eight verses would be the most well-known Bible verses almost in the world, because there's a song written about them that basically almost word for word spell out these lyrics. It's been covered lots and lots of times, but I guess its most famous version was by the Byrds in 1965. In 1965, a generation of the world was gripped in fear and turmoil because of a war that nobody wanted to fight. There were thousands dying in Vietnam, and those images of those deaths and those battles were being beamed back into people's living room through television. This was a generation that saw the futility of war, the tragedy of war, and it was a generation crying out for peace. And it was in the midst of this quest for peace that a culture of music that echoed the cry of this generation developed. Plenty of songs spoke about the futility of war, about a hope for something better, a longing to take people past the war they found themselves a part of. Right at the very heart of this musical revolution was the Byrds' cover of Peter Seeger's song, Turn, 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 with lyrics taken almost exclusively from the first eight verses of Ecclesiastes chapter 3. The song raced to number one in 1965 because it echoed a generation's cry for peace and hope. But I guess we have to ask, based on what we know about Ecclesiastes, why did the words of one of the most depressing books in the Bible give a generation such hope? So far in Ecclesiastes, we've seen this book is like the journal of an incredibly rich, incredibly powerful king who is on a quest for meaning in this life. And yet he observes that everything he could see under the sun, everything he could see in this life, found a depressing, meaningless monotony, a chasing after the wind. If we search for meaning in this world, we will struggle to find it. And so when we come to chapter 3 in the famous song of verses 1 to 8, we need to read it in the context that it was written. Surely this is just another outworking of the monotony we saw last week. At first glance, the passage is a poetic summary of life based around 14 equal and opposite pairs of events that happen in the course of human existence, over which there seems to be absolutely no control. Let's look at a few of them. A time to be born and a time to die. Everything being equal, they are two dates you don't get to choose. You generally don't get to choose the day that you're born, and you generally don't get to choose the day you die. A time to plant and a time to pluck up what is planted. Planting stuff, harvesting things. We think we choose the days we do this, but really they're governed by the seasons. You don't plant a summer crop in winter. You don't reap stuff unless you planted it at the right time. A time to kill and a time to heal. A time to break down and a time to build up. A time to weep and a time to laugh. You don't set out on any given day and say, I think I'm going to laugh a lot today, or I think I'm going to cry a lot today. And they are responses to what happens in life, that things that are outside of your control. A time to mourn, a time to dance, a time to cast away stones and a time to gather stones together, a little bit random. This is an agricultural term where casting stones onto a field meant the field was useless. So that's where you chucked all your rubbish or the bits that weren't useful. And gathering stones together meant that you were taking the stones off a field because the field was ready to be planted. A time to embrace and a time to refrain from embracing. A time to seek and a time to lose. A time to keep and a time to cast away. A time to tear and a time to sow. A time to keep silence and a time to speak. A time to love and a time to hate. A time for war and a time of peace. Solomon moves poetically through all the seasons of our life to show the ebb and flow of our existence. The bird's song spoke to a confused generation longing for something more because they saw in those ebbs and flows a beautiful rhythm to life that gave them hope that while they were facing war today, they would one day enjoy peace. Kind of like hoping in a cosmic pendulum that will eventually swing them away from their current woes and towards something so much better. There was hope that if life was a rhythm, if life was a pendulum, that one day the pendulum would swing in their favor. But in the context of Ecclesiastes, Solomon wants us to feel something very different. Rather than just seeing the ebb and flow of life as hope for liberation, hope that one day the pendulum would swing in our favor, he wants us to actually see this as a burden. To see this rhythm, to see this pendulum swing, to see this back and forth as a burden. Verse 9, once again, he asked a question that's been at the forefront of his mind throughout this book so far. What gain has the worker from all his toil? In other words, the worker is in the midst of this ebb and flow, this pendulum swing. The worker is riding the pendulum through life, planting one day, letting the pendulum swing, harvesting another day. That the worker is going through life, swinging back and forth on this pendulum, and yet he still asks, what has been gained by the worker? What is the point of life? Why should the worker bother working? And goes on to keep talking in verse 10. I have seen the busyness that God has given to the children of man to be busy with. He has made everything beautiful in its time. Also, he has put eternity into man's heart. Yet so that he cannot find out what God has done from the beginning to the end. It's like he's saying, God has inflicted humanity with this pendulum swinging cycle of life. But it is a cycle of beauty. Beauty because while everything is cycling, it eventually will cycle to something beautiful. We are in jacaranda season here at the moment in Brisbane, and it's probably the most stunning time to live in Brisbane because there are these trees that for 11 months of the year are completely nondescript, really. You don't even notice them. They're just either bare or they're green and they just blend into the treescape. You hardly notice them. But come October or November, depending on what time it's actually going to blossom, it just bursts out in this purple that's unmistakable and unmissable. You can go through a whole year thinking there's just a normal tree in your backyard. then all of a sudden, you're like, oh, I didn't realize that was a jacaranda, but now it's purple. I know it's a jacaranda. It's like they just burst out and they're beautiful in their season. It's like that Solomon is saying everything in life has its jacaranda moment, that moment when we see the beauty of why it actually exists. But more than just an observation of seasonal beauty, Solomon declares that this beauty lifts our hearts beyond the physical world. He has put eternity into man's heart. When we see the unpredictable, yet completely measured and controlled cycle of the seasons of life, we know that there must be more to our existence than what we see before us. More than a superstitious wish that we will have more laughing than weeping, more peace than war. Our hearts are actually given a transcendent vision of the divine. And so with the weight of God's providence, the beauty that he creates, and the hint of eternity that lingers in our heart, the human soul cries out to know God. But the text tells us that all of this transcendent beauty comes to nothing. Because while eternity has been placed in our hearts, it has been done so that he cannot find out what God has done from the beginning to the end. This is the burden that Solomon wants us to feel. This is the burden that he speaks of. In our lives, in the midst of all the monotony, the meaninglessness, there is this beautiful sense of the divine. Creation and providence give us a hint that there must be eternity. There must be something beyond our meaningless existence. But we humans are incapable of figuring this God out. Solomon is saying that if you simply look at the cycles and the seasons of life in a quest for meaning, you will only feel burden and frustration of knowing that God exists, that something beyond you is controlling your life, but you'll never know that God personally. You'll never fathom what God has really done. And so he concludes in verses 12 and 13. I know there is nothing better for men than to be happy and to do good while they live, that everyone may eat and drink and find satisfaction in all his toil. This is the gift of God. If there is nothing better than living your life being tossed back and forth on the unpredictable and ever-changing pendulum of life, then you might as well enjoy it. You might as well find whatever you can within that existence and value its beauty and enjoy it as much as you possibly can and be satisfied in that. And this is where our society today is at. Our culture says there's probably no such thing as God. There's no meaning or purpose in my life other than that which I can create for myself. So my goal in life is actually to enjoy it as much as I can. So we have a society that will strive for riches and power and prestige in order to numb their feelings of meaningless and insignificance. A culture that indulges in the best food, the best wine, the best coffee, and fashion in order to hide their boredom with normality. And a society that, when all this fails, will attempt to escape their depression through binge drinking, recreational drugs, sexual experimentation, travel, whatever it is. If you view life through a lens that says, I can't really understand God, the result will always be a search for meaning in that which you can see, in the pleasures and the luxuries and the beauty of this life. Once again, Solomon has left us feeling pretty depressed. It almost seems as though, is this the Bible? Like, just to leave us eat, drink, and be merry, kind of. Surely that's not the Bible's message. Surely that's not what life is like. Surely the beauty of life is so much greater than this. In verse 14, Solomon continues, I perceive that whatever God does endures forever. Nothing can be added to it nor anything taken from it. God has done it so that people fear before him. So while looking at God's providence over the season of our lives, from a completely godless perspective, results in this hopeless hedonism. It's not God's plan for our lives. It's not God's plan for exercising control over the seasons of our lives. God's plan was for people to revere him, for people to fear him. He is not wanting us to focus on the actual pendulum swings of life and find hope in the chance that the pendulum might swing our way one day. Nor is he wanting us to see that everything has been made beautiful in its time and chase after that beauty as a way to fill the void in our hearts. Rather, he wants us to realize that there is one who is sovereign over the pendulum, one who causes the beauty to flourish, and we should stand in awe of him. In fact, what Solomon recognizes here is just how small he is against the backdrop of God's providence. God, in his sovereignty, controls our lives, and in many ways, we have very little control over which side of the equation we dwell, whether the pendulum is swinging for our good or whether the pendulum is swinging against us. Solomon knows this in his own life. He's a king. He's a sovereign king. And one of his jobs was to settle disputes between people. Every time two parties walked into his court and came before him, one would leave rejoicing and one would leave weeping. He knows what it is to make sovereign decisions that affect the lives of people. And he does it as a king so that people would fear him as a king, revere him as a king, honor him as a king, so that the nation would respect their leadership. And so Solomon knows what it is to be sovereign over the fortune of others and expect people to revere him on account of that reality. In the same way, Solomon expects that we will revere the pendulum swinger rather than getting too caught up in which way the pendulum swings. See, God does not want to remain distant and unfathomable from his people. He desires to be in relationship with his people, but he desires that relationship to be a right relationship. Right throughout our Proverbs series and now into Ecclesiastes, we have seen that that right relationship is defined by this idea of the fear of the Lord. A relationship where we, the creation, revere and honor him as our creator. This is wisdom. This is what gives us the key to understanding life, the key to understanding everything, that we might live with a trembling trust in the one who is all powerful over our existence. And yet when Solomon looks out at the world, a world that's supposed to be controlled by God, a world whose seasons and pendulum swings were supposed to demonstrate God's reverence, he saw that instead it was filled with injustice. Verse 16, moreover, I saw that under the sun, that in the place of justice, even there was wickedness. And in the place of righteousness, even there was wickedness. The place of justice would have been the judicial system of the nation. Solomon looks at it and goes, it's corrupt. There's wickedness that exists there. Judges are making decisions because they've been bribed or because they are more partial to one person than another. The place of righteousness was the religious system of the nation. And here too, Solomon saw wickedness. Instead of God's truth being delivered to people, there was corruption. There was the neglect of the poor. There was the feathering of the nest of the religious leaders at the expense of the poor. the places that were supposed to be the center of the nation's soul, the places of stability and consistency for people who were riding the pendulum of life, even these places were corrupt. And so Solomon again defers to the sovereign God, telling us in verse 17, God will judge the righteous and the wicked, for there is a time for every matter and for every work. Just as there is a time for every season under the sun, there also is a time for everything to come under God's judgment. A time when the pendulum will finally stop swinging and God will call us to account. A time when those who revered the sovereign God will be revealed as righteous, and those who ignored him and chased their own pleasure will be revealed as wicked. And so here's the dilemma of Ecclesiastes 3. If you view life through a godless lens, then you end up seeing nothing more than a cycle of seasons of life that you are at the mercy of, a pendulum swing that you have no control over. So if you say, I better make the most of this life while I can and plunge into whatever I can find and get as much pleasure and satisfaction as I can. But as you do that, you can't help but think about the beauty of creation, the divine control of life, and how it points to eternity, how it points to something beyond this world, how it pricks in you a God consciousness, that everything I see, the complexity, the beauty, the rhythm, everything I see in this ordered creation points to the fact that there is a God beyond me. But then you despair because you can't figure out that God. He is unfathomable to you. And so you reserve the right to just plunge back into life, plunge back into your pursuit of pleasure and prestige. But the reality is that you will be judged based on what you do in your life by this God that you cannot fathom. This is what it is to live the pendulum of life with a godless perspective. To look at that pendulum without God is to walk this, or swing on this pendulum back and forth. There's beauty. It points to God, but I can't fathom God. So I'm just going to plunge into life, but the more of life I see, the more pleasure I get, the more I see there must be something more, there must be something, but I can't understand him. And eventually you will be judged. And so Solomon concludes in verses 18 to 20 by giving us the hopeless outcome of a life without this right view of God, without this reverence, without this fear of God. And it's an inability to see how you're any different from an animal. Verse 18, I said in my heart with regard to the children of man that God is testing them that they may see that they themselves are but beasts. For what happens to the children of man and what happens to the beast is the same. As one dies, so the other dies. They all have the same breath, and man has no advantage over the beasts, for all is vanity. All go to one place. All are from the dust, and to dust all return. Nothing like Solomon's Ecclesiastes to get us feeling happy on a Sunday morning. But he's asking two very important questions, and they're best summarized in verse 21 and 22. Verse 21. Who knows if the spirit of man rises upward and the spirit of the animal goes down into the earth? And verse 22, for who can bring him to see what will happen after him? Solomon is asking a question that kind of has always rattled around in the heads of humanity. Are we really any different than the animals? Are we really any different than the beasts of the field? Am I really any different from the mosquito I squatted last night? Am I different from the animals? And if so, how? How do we know that our actions are somehow higher and more developed than the beasts? What guarantees do we have that our soul will live forever rather than be merely flesh that returns to the dust and the ground? We live in a world today that is more confused on this question possibly than ever before. Informed by godless theories of evolution, we're told to celebrate the fact that we are soulless animals, that we are just another mammal, only different from the beasts because of a million years' worth of good genetic luck. And so there are scores of people riding the pendulum swings of life with nothing to ground them other than hoping that they make the most out of the good times and somehow survive the bad times. The same way that an animal walks the field, strolls the forest, hoping that a predator doesn't get them, hoping that they're able to find some food today, hoping that they're able to find a mate, reproduce, so that their genetic code will continue. That is what life is like for so many people. It seems no different than the beasts of the field. But here's the question that I believe we need to ask ourselves if we claim to believe in God. If you are just living for the pleasures and treasures of this world, how are you any different from the animals? If that is all you are seeking is another meal, another place to live, if that's all you're seeking, then how are you different? If you look at your life and see an ignorance of God and a blind pursuit of whatever makes you feel happy, comfortable, or significant, what confidence do you have that you will head up to heaven while the animals will simply return to the dust? How are we handling the pendulum swings of life any better than the godless unbeliever? In our Proverbs series, we looked at things like anger and words and pride and the sovereignty of God that swings the pendulum of life and how our lives so quickly mood changes based on where the pendulum is. If the pendulum swings against me, I'm very quickly angry and I speak harsh words and I get angry at God. The pendulum swings my way, then I'm a great person to be around. And the pendulum can swing quite quickly. How are we handling the pendulum of life any better than a godless unbeliever? Solomon's point here is that there is no certainty in life for anyone who ignores God. No hope for the one who pursues his meaningless work in order to eat, drink, and be merry. And so he asks on their behalf if there is any way that they can know what happens after they die. And this is where the chapter ends. This is where this thought is left hanging, seemingly with no hope of finding an answer to this question. This question of verse 22. Who can bring him to see what happens after him? What happens after we die? No one. From Solomon's perspective, if you look at this world without the fear of the Lord, there is no one who can show you what happens to you after you die. Because everyone who's died has stayed dead. Their bodies have returned to the ground and they can't tell you what happens next. There is no certainty. So you may as well make the most of this life that you have before you die. This is where the chapter ends. It just leaves us hanging. For the one absorbed in the quest for meaning in a godless framework, there is no way of knowing what happens to you after you die. But remember, God's desire is not for us to think of him as unfathomable, but rather to be in relationship with him, to be in right relationship with him, to know him and to be known by him, for us to revere him. Galatians chapter 4, verses 4 to 5 tells us, when the time had fully come, read here, when the pendulum had swung to the right place, God sent his son, born of a woman, born under the law, to redeem those under the law, that we might receive the full rights as sons. God chose to send his son into the cycle of the seasons of this life. The one who actually swung the pendulum chose to embrace the pendulum swings of this life. Jesus stepped into this world. He was born and he died. And the pendulum swung in his life every day of it, just like it does for us. But I want you to think about what happened to him when he came. Think about how the pendulum swung for Jesus. He came to build up, but the world broke him down. He came to embrace, but the world pushed him away. He came to seek, but the world wanted to stay lost. He came to speak, but the world silenced him. He came to love, but the world hated him. He came to heal, but the world killed him. Jesus always swung the pendulum towards hope. Always when he came into someone's life, their life changed for the better. But the world always ripped it back towards hopelessness. Jesus felt the place of wickedness in the place of justice. Jesus felt wickedness in the place of righteousness. False trial, false witnesses, unjustly condemned. By who? The people who were supposed to be the place of righteousness, the religious leaders of his day. But when he had been crushed, when he had been silenced, when he had been killed, Jesus did something that no man had ever done. Jesus triumphed over the grave, rising from the dead so that he can come to you this morning and say, I can bring you to see what will happen after you die. I can show you what happens after you die. I am one who did not decay in the ground. I am one who did not return to dust. I faced the death that all of you will die. I faced that death and I have triumphed out the other side. I can show you where you will go after you die. Jesus lived our life in the cycle and the seasons and the pendulum swings of life, right from birth unto death, to show us that there is hope beyond the pendulum. There is hope beyond this life, that there is something more. God has put eternity in our hearts, and Jesus has shown us the destination that eternity is. And so for the one who trusts God, the one who has right relationship with God, the one who fears God, or in the context of Jesus coming, the one who clings to Christ through all of the pendulum swings of life, through the good times, through the bad times, through the monotonous and average times, the one who clings to Christ will be shown where they go after they die. Because where is Jesus now? Where is Jesus now? He is at the right hand of the Father in heaven, in complete paradise. That is where Jesus is, and that is where you will go if you are in right relationship with him. Paul says, to be absent from the body, to be dead, is to be present with the Lord. I don't know how often we think about Jesus' life and death and resurrection and ascension like this, but it's kind of like a trajectory. Jesus shows us what our life can be like. He lives the life that we were supposed to live. He dies a death that we deserve to die, but he triumphs in resurrection and rises to the right hand of the Father. And that is what will happen to us if we trust him. That we will swing through the pendulums of life, and then one day we will die. But if we cling to Christ, there is eternity for us. It's not just in our hearts, it is tangible and within our grasp. it is understandable because God revealed himself through Jesus. And through Jesus, he's brought us to see what will happen after we die. I don't want anyone here this morning to leave here thinking that life is just about riding out the pendulum swings, doing the best while times are good and somehow managing to hold on when times aren't so good. If that is the entirety of existence for you, then my heart breaks for you, because that is not life as it was designed to be lived. Life as it was designed to be lived is in the fear of the Lord, in clinging to Jesus Christ and seeing that no matter which way the pendulum swings, there is hope guaranteed, sewn up, made real in eternity for you. And if you put your trust in him, he will get you through every pendulum swing and take you to the right hand of the Father. That is where he is, and that is where you, if you trust him, will be also. So I would plead with you to cling to this Jesus, to reach out for him, even in the midst of the monotony of life, so that you might find certainty that you are so much better than an animal, that there is so much more value and worth in you than an animal, and that God will take you to be with him. Let's pray. Father, I want to thank you. I want to thank you that you are in control of the pendulum. Because the alternative is to view this life totally out of control. And that the things that happen to us are just completely random. Lord, I want to thank you that even in the midst of the bad swings of that pendulum, that we can trust you. That we can revere you, that we can fear you as the one who is in control. And Lord, I want to thank you for making everything beautiful in its time, for giving everything its jacaranda moment, so that in that we can see there is so much more to this life than what we can see, that there is eternity in our hearts, that there is something beyond our existence. And I want to thank you for giving us Jesus to show us what that something is. To show us that there is more to life, that there is life after death, that there is your right hand and paradise and a guaranteed inheritance with Jesus. So Lord, help us to cling to this Jesus. Help us to see him as the tangible, fathomable God that you are, and help us to cling to him so that we might arrive with him at your right hand in glory. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.